Advance Peace is a gun violence reduction program that started in Richmond, California. Sacramento just wrapped up its first year as a pilot city. On Inside, some of the promising results. I'll talk with Sacramento News and Review reporter Scott Thomas Anderson to better understand the statistics and stories. Then, the remarkable journey of a rare manuscript from a remote church in Armenia to a Los Angeles courtroom. It's a true story. Dr. Hegnar Wattenpah traces it in her acclaimed book, The Missing Pages. She'll be here with us to share the story in just a bit. And Cole Kushner has launched another season. Cole is the host and creator of the popular podcast Dissect. In this new season, he analyzes the album Flower Boy by Tyler, the Creator. I'm Beth Ruriak. That's all coming up today on Insight. Live from Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight, where we're exploring how issues and events connect us to this region. I'm Beth Ruriak. In 2017, it was provocative, and I think you could say hopeful, for the city of Sacramento to say yes to a program out of Richmond, California called Advance Peace, as in push peace forward. In fact, Sacramento became the first city in the country to say yes to this program, but there had been a summer of gun violence then. Five people had been hurt in one day in Meadowview in gang fighting. And if this was a program that could end some of the violence, the reasoning went, city leaders were willing to try it. So 2018 became the first full year of Advance Peace in Sacramento. A progress report has been completed. It's not yet been released to the public, but Sacramento News and Review reporter Scott Thomas Anderson has seen a draft. He's worked through the statistics, and he's here to talk about this reporting. Hi, Scott. Glad to have you here.
Good morning, Beth.
Not just statistics, though, right?
These are human stories. They have a lot to do with all these makeshift memorials we see on sidewalks all over North and South Sacramento and Oak Park, all these funerals for teenagers that happen in the area. So they need to be looked at as more than statistics. They need to be looked at as real people. In a lot of cases, children and teenagers that, you know, are dying.
What is what I'm going to call the impact headline of this progress report?
There's a lot of really interesting and positive statistics in it, but I think the biggest one is every participant so far in the program is still alive, and that includes 35 teenagers. So about 67 young adults and 35 teenagers.
To say that everybody's still alive probably needs some context, because I think most people start out thinking they're going to live through a day and enjoy a day.
Yeah. So Advance Peace looks to identify the most at-risk young people, young adults and teenagers, who are most likely to either be a gang shooter or the victim of a gang shooting, and bring those folks into a program, which they call a fellowship, and provide them with various wraparound services. That's trying to get them employment training. That's trying to get them mental health services, counseling, and just give them mentoring and life skills to put them on a different trajectory.
As part of this progress report, there's the phrase, six, only six, had a new firearm injury. Of all these participants, more than 100, the fact that only six had a firearm injury is highly significant.
It is when you consider that these fellows were carefully picked as the most at-risk young people to die on the streets. Yeah.
So the broad outlines of the Advance Peace program became controversial. If I said things like mentoring or mental health treatment or assistance in education, that all sounds really positive. But there was one word that threw a spin on this for a lot of people, and that word was cash.
Right. So when this program first was discussed in the summer of 2017, it came in front of the city council then. And the mayor's task force on gang prevention had carefully examined and vetted the program at that point. But somehow one element of the program, which involves paying a supportive financial stipend to participants if they make it really far into the program and do really well with turning their lives around, And that stipend is to help with housing, family obligations, and education, things like that. It got labeled as, in sort of broad headlines, as paying criminals not to commit crimes, or I think one news report referred to it as paying gang members for a ceasefire. And I think those are wildly misleading headlines because, first of all, out of all the people that are in the program now, as of the progress report, none had even received the stipend. There's only two people that are under consideration for it right now because they've made that much progress in the program. So it's not like this program is just putting large amounts of cash into people's hands at all. People have to, what they call, map out new life goals and be taking positive steps towards achieving those goals, and then they can get a little financial help. And I think it's also worth mentioning that a lot of these young people live in neighborhoods that have suffered from generations of disinvestment and have high poverty rates. So that's a significant part of the picture, too.
I think it helps to understand how it actually happens on the street. So give me the example of one of the participants and some of the experience over the last year under the Advanced Peace umbrella.
Right. And I think it's important to mention there are other programs and other nonprofits that are doing really great work around at-risk youth and that are have the potential to die in gang violence. But what makes Advanced Peace unique, I believe, is that they identify the most at risk and the ones that probably aren't going to make it in the other programs. Mm-hmm. These are the ones that are pretty far into the life already. And so Advanced Peace assigns them an around-the-clock mentor that works 24/7 if that young person calls them with a problem or is having thoughts of doing something that they know they shouldn't do, and that mentor is going to respond immediately. And we can just see from the progress report some anecdotal stories of mentors intervening and stopping these young people from making a bad decision because they're always available. And you know, one note in the progress report is that they know for sure that they've stopped at least 17 retaliatory shootings just in 2018 mm-hmm. through that kind of outreach.
You quote the example of one of these mentors or life coaches, I guess mm-hmm. you could say, giving this testimonial. You wrote, he got a phone call saying that one of his fellows, and that's the name of the participant, they're called fellows, was walking down a busy known street with a gun in his backpack. He was on a mission to do some damage. I caught up with him. I talked him into my vehicle. I detoured him off his mission. And so the thinking is that the repetitive sort of detouring is the word that's being used, and the incentives of tools for a different life will be able to change some of these people forever from the path they were on.
That's the hope, yeah. And I think if you look at the fact that the program's doing a couple, well, several different things at the same time, it's providing that on-the-spot intervention basically at all times for these young people if they reach out. And then separate from that, it is trying to get them job training. It is trying to get them into better housing. It is trying to get them into counseling. And it is trying to just mentor them into figuring out a different kind of life where that's outside of the gang sphere.
You're listening to Sacramento News and Review reporter Scott Thomas Anderson. We have posted a link to his article that will appear in this week's News and Review, but you can find it at capradio.org/insight. This is a crime deterrent, a gun violence reduction program, but law enforcement isn't fully on board with it. There were a number of people in Sacramento who really objected to it. There were even objections from the Sacramento County Sheriff, Scott Jones. So where is the disconnect in having faith that this will work?
It's new. It's only been done in the city of Richmond. And so even though the numbers in the city of Richmond are amazingly good in terms of a 56% reduction in homicides and gun attacks, it has only been done there. So right now, Sacramento, Stockton are the first two cities to see if that strategy in Richmond can apply to any urban environment with similar results. So I think that's number one, is that it's new. When this was all discussed, Sacramento Police Chief Daniel Hahn was open to it, as long as, I think his words were, as long as it wasn't being seen as just a silver bullet, like the one thing that can stop all these problems from happening. So I think Chief Han was publicly somewhat supportive, as long as people were recognizing that certain gang suppression tactics from the police are still going to be necessary to, to control the violence and killing, too.
I think the program has some intriguing names for what are called the touch points, the life map goals, the daily check-ins, we've referenced that, social services navigation, transformative travel, elder circle. Elders in the realm of the participant being able to influence and help guide, internship opportunities, a milestone allowance. We're also going to post a link to a past Insight conversation that includes the founder in Richmond, Devon Barone, talking about the success there. So if only two, you said, are eligible or in the realm of the stipend, what's the incentive been as you read the draft of the report? What's the description from participants for wanting to stay in Advanced Peace?
It sounds like it's that personal interaction. It sounds like it's adult figures, mentor figures, showing these young people that they really care about their lives, that they care about what happens to them, that they're not just a crime statistic to them, that they're not just some statistic that could be going into juvenile hall or the state prison system, that they're real people to them, and that their lives, even though they live in very challenged neighborhoods, that their lives matter. So I think that's probably been the biggest incentive so far. And I think more people will get far enough into the program where they may be eligible for those stipends.
Another important headline, though, and I don't want to gloss over this, is that there were no murders of children in the year. In 12 months, no murders of children. Does that mean children related to the fellows, to the participants, or how's that being measured?
Well, so in 2018, the city of Sacramento made it 12 months without having a person under 18 murdered. I think there were a number of really important things going on at the time. One of them is this broad coalition of health professionals and faith leaders and mentors called the Black Child Legacy Campaign. And they were focusing on four different areas, and one of them was child murders. And Advanced Peace has been working in conjunction with them, and then also other nonprofits in the area, the various community centers in the city that have different outreach programs for troubled youth. So there's a lot of different people who have done really hard work that have played into that victory of not having any child murders in 2018. But I do think it's worth asking what was different about 2018 than all the previous years when we didn't have that stat. And the one thing that was different was Advanced Peace.
But the truth is that to attribute it to any one program or one factor isn't clear and
it's
can't
not.
Be done.
No, it can't be. And I think there's no way to talk about that statistic without talking about the Black Child Legacy Campaign and just the amazing volume of work they've done.
UC Berkeley has a program that is tracking this program's progress. Are there other trackers, and how is the tracking being done?
Well, so that's new. UC Berkeley just started a scientific statistical analysis of its progress, and we won't have that anytime soon. But I think the next progress report, or potentially the one after that, will finally have a more scientific way to gauge how much progress was made if we're only looking at the numbers. But again, like you said, it's human stories too. So for every time Del Paso Heights, Oak Park, South Sacramento is not having a teenager's funeral, that's probably more important than the numbers. Hmm.
Sacramento's initial commitment to this program was for 4 years, with the agreement that after two, the city manager, Howard Chan, would do a review. In the short term, with this one-year progress report, it has gone to the city council at this point?
They've been briefed on it. It hasn't been put on a public agenda yet where people can see it on the city's website, but the council members have been briefed on it, yeah.
Anything else that stood out to you in looking at the draft of the report that raised questions or made you want to kind of hone in on an area to watch?
I think the fact that The ages, the average ages. So there's the adult fellowship program, which is anyone over 18, and the junior fellowship program, which is 12 to 17. And the average age in the adult program was 24. The average age in the teen program was 15. So even when we're talking about the adult program, we're talking about very young people. Mm-hmm. We're talking about young men who, you know, have a lot of life ahead of them if this program can work for them.
Any dollar figure attached to it? Any price tag in the report?
Well, like you said, you know, the city council committed $1.5 million to get the program off the ground for 4 years, which the city of Sacramento's annual budget's $1 billion. So it's a very, very modest financial investment, but I think it's a very significant political investment in Del Paso Heights, Oak Park, and South Sacramento.
All right, Scott, thanks for joining us. Sounds like we'll be checking in on this one again.
Thanks for having me.
That is Scott Thomas Anderson. We have posted a link to his story about Advance Peace Sacramento 1 year in. It will be in this week's Sacramento News and Review, which is on newsstands later this week. But the link is at capradio.org/insight. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. April 24th is Armenian Genocide Remembrance Day. But there is a chapter of the genocide story you probably don't know, even if you studied this in history classes. It involves the Armenian Church, the J. Paul Getty Museum, and a lawsuit over part of a medieval manuscript. UC Davis art professor Dr. Hegnar Zeitlian-Wattenpah traces this remarkable story in her latest book. It is titled The Missing Pages, and the book was recently a new and noteworthy selection by the New York Times. Dr. Wattenpah, great to have you back on Insight.
I'm delighted to be here.
So where and when does this story begin?
Well, for me, the story began on June 1, 2010, when I read a news item that the Armenian Church had sued the J. Paul Getty Museum. And I was stunned because, of course, I'm a member of the Armenian Church. I've also been a Getty Fellow. So it was as if two parts of my identity had come into conflict. And I wanted to know more about what the dispute was about.
The rest of the story begins centuries ago.
In the middle of the 13th century, in a beautiful castle on the Euphrates River, where the person who is now recognized as the greatest Armenian medieval artist, Toros Roslin, created a beautiful gospels for his patron, the head of the Armenian church.
What we end up talking about is 8 pages of a manuscript. So I think in context, we have to talk about what you call the mother manuscript, mm-hmm. and then these 8 pages. As an art object, as an artifact in the world, what is this and what does it mean?
Originally, the object that was created was a gospel book with a beautiful binding. At some point in the during the events of the Armenian Genocide, 8 beautifully illuminated pages were separated from the main manuscript. And the manuscript ended up decades later and in the Republic of Armenia, whereas those 8 glittering pages ended up at the Getty Museum. These pages are canon tables, which are like an index of sorts to the Gospels. And they're beautifully illuminated with abstract ornament, but also these wonderful animals and fruits, and including those 2 roosters that are on the cover of my book that stride very confidently towards a vase.
Let's go back to Toros Roslin. He's a bit of a mystery himself. How is it that he came to create what have become some of the most powerful, holy, and rare images in the world?
that was one of the mysteries I had to confront. I realized that the person that we now recognize as one of the most important medieval artists, we knew nothing about him for seven centuries. His name completely disappeared from history. We know very little about him, but what we do know about him comes from his own words. He signed his name in the seven manuscripts that are known to be by him, and he says a few things about himself, the name of his brother, but he spends most of his time talking about his patrons and with pious invocations.
Let me go back to your first words about this. You were reading a newspaper, and you saw an article in June of 2010. What was happening as you read that article, and what did you decide to do next?
I was really intrigued with the way in which the two sides were characterizing the work in question.
The Armenian Church versus the J. Paul Getty Museum.
For the Armenian Church, this was a sacred object that had miraculous powers. For the J. Paul Getty Museum, this was a beautiful work of art that deserved to be in a great collection and to be shown to the largest public.
So let's go back to that manuscript. It had stayed for centuries in a tiny church somewhere, a remote church, right?
A remote church in a mountain village alongside many other medieval relics. But only this manuscript has survived from all of the treasures in the churches and monasteries of that area.
So the manuscript moved intact, and then came the era of World War I. Mm-hmm. And what happened?
That was the period of time that was under contention in the lawsuit. And from what is possible to reconstruct is that the manuscript was taken out of the remote town of the church that it was in for all these centuries, and it moved from place to place. And at some point, the eight pages, the canon tables, were separated from the rest of the manuscript and made their own way through Ellis Island and eventually to Los Angeles.
There had been a stop in Aleppo at one point, wasn't there?
It is not exactly clear how they got to Aleppo, but the Archbishop of Aleppo did a complete description of the pages.
And you know this not only by following documents, but you literally traveled the path that the manuscript and the eight pages traveled.
Yes, that was one of the things I wanted to do to understand this manuscript, is to retrace its steps, to go to the various places where it had been, even when there was not much left of the places and buildings where the manuscript spent time. So I went to Hromgla, the castle on the Euphrates, where it was created, to Zeytun, the mountain town, where it last served as a religious object, to Marash, another town where it experienced some, it was lost, the manuscript was lost, then found again, and also the Republic of Armenia, where the main manuscript, the mother manuscript, is preserved today.
Other than this court case in Los Angeles, a lot of this story was unknown, or even if pieces of it were known, it hadn't been constructed as an entire biography before, had it?
It had not. And that was the revelation for me, how the life of this manuscript over its 700 years was also a way in which one could tell the history of the Armenian people.
At what point did you say, I've got to be all in on this? I have to commit to wholly telling the story. I can't just write a short story about, you know, when it stopped in Aleppo, for example.
There was some sense at the beginning that I would focus on the court case, because it was a very interesting court case and brings up a lot of issues about the responsibilities of museums today. How should works of art be displayed that are also religious objects? But at some point, it became clear to me that the entirety of the life of this object was powerful, and that the court case was one episode of its long and fascinating life.
You are listening to Dr. Hegnar Zeitlian Wattenpah. She is professor of art history at UC Davis, professor of urban and architectural history in Islamic studies at UC Davis, and she is the author of the new book we're talking about, The Missing Pages, The Modern Life of a Medieval Manuscript from genocide to justice. She is going to present more of the story than you're hearing here at the Minetti Schrem Museum on the UC Davis campus, April 25th at 7 p.m. The day before, April 24th, I referenced as Armenian Genocide Remembrance Day. Is this observed nearly all over the world except Turkey?
It is observed all over the world, and in the last few years, it has also been observed in Turkey by members of human rights associations who come together in near Taksim Square in Istanbul and other places as well, in order to remember this this crime and this tragedy that is not publicly and officially acknowledged in Turkey.
And speak to that, why it continues to remain controversial, and some people might not know the history of the genocide.
One of the burdens that Armenian genocide faces is that the events continue to be denied by the successor state to the Ottoman Empire that was the perpetrator state of the genocide. And it has become part of the foundation myth of the Turkish state that there was no founding crime, that these are all lies. And even though in the last few years there has been tremendous work by various Turkish citizens in order to think about the foundation of their state, the continued history of violence and impunity in that state, and to really do a thorough work of memory, officially, that denial is still official policy.
What do you consider to be the homeland of the Armenian people?
Goodness.
I know that's a very big, much debated, much written about question. I'm just curious about someone who studies the history, the art history, the placing of objects, the tracing of objects. What in your mind represents homeland?
I've visited my ancestral homelands that are today in Turkey, my father's village near the Mediterranean in the Musada Mountain. And I feel a deep sense of connectedness to that place, though I know that I am not going to return there. Many of my Armenian friends feel a very deep connection to the Republic of Armenia, as do I. But I think objects like the Zeytun Gospels are also, that are the part of which is now at the Getty. These objects are also places that create, they're objects that create spaces where we are at home, where we can connect with our culture, our religion, and the deep roots of faith and beauty that our ancestors created for us today.
That brings us back, I guess, to the court case. What happened? What was decided?
After 5 years of mediation and litigation, the church and the Getty settled. The Getty acknowledged that the eight pages had always been, had historically been the church's, and the church in turn donated the pages at the Getty. So the pages remain in Los Angeles. And the mother manuscripts remain in Armenia.
How much time have you spent pondering over them, looking at them in the Getty where they now reside?
I've been very fortunate to visit them several times. And I think those pages, even though they are so small, are some of for me, it is the most beautiful work of art in the world. Every time I see them, I find new visual events, new elements that I had not suspected. The parchment is has a beautiful color, and some of the colors, like the red dots, have an almost three-dimensional quality. I think they're endlessly fascinating, and they're also sacred objects.
Would you paint more of a picture? Describe the size in inches, for example, and how is it that over such a long period of time, the integrity of the colors on the pages has stayed strong?
The Zaytun Gospels, of which the eight pages are a part, like many particularly valued gospel books in medieval times, were not really meant to be leafed through. Those beautiful illuminations were not really meant to be seen by everyone. So the manuscript spent most of its time as a sacred relic in a special box in a niche in the church on the citadel of Zaytun. It was taken out on special occasions in processions around the city in order to ensure the protection of the town and its people. So most people probably saw it as this dazzling object with a beautiful binding that the priest would raise above the congregation. And that explains why the manuscript enjoys such a good state of preservation, even though it is 700 years old. It was rarely used. And the canon tables that you can on occasion see at the Getty are a combination of very abstract and very lively. And you are basically seeing an architectural frame, an ornate architectural frame, and within that are rows of numbers, which are the index. It's a concordance list of similar passages that appear in various gospels. For medieval Christianity, this index was extremely important theologically because it showed you how the four gospels were connected. They told the same story, and they also connected the New Testament to the Old Testament prophecies.
They are tiny.
Each page is about 8.5 by 11, the pages that you have on your desk.
As opposed to what we might think of in more modern times as the big Bible, for example, or the big Torah, the very large,
Absolutely.
Grand.
It's a tiny object that demands your attention, that demands that you look at them in a very specific way.
Because we are talking about the power of objects and architecture, would you talk with me about the Notre Dame Cathedral?
Mm.
And with the fire happening, there's a phrase you use in your book in talking about objects when it becomes the survivor object,
mm-hmm.
when it has a story to tell, for example, the manuscript moving through the genocide and through war. So how, in your mind, has the Notre Dame Cathedral shifted now in its existence and power in the world?
Well, when we all saw those photographs of Notre Dame burning, those of us who are not French, who are not Catholic, maybe who have not seen Notre Dame in person, except maybe in photos or in a certain Disney movie, Notre Dame, we all felt anguish and terror and maybe even visceral pain. And that really shows us how important cultural heritage is to us, to all of humanity, not only to the people of Paris or to the French. Notre Dame, of course, in its very long life, it actually was created around the same time as the Zaytun Gospels. It was completed in 1260. Mm. The Zaytun Gospels was created in 1256. So in its long life, it has seen many depredations, the French Revolution, the assaults that it encountered during the First and Second World Wars, many other fires and other kinds of problems, and of course also decay over the course of time. So the fire that we saw recently was devastating, but this will not be the end of Notre Dame's life. It will be the beginning of a new phase of its life. And we're already seeing some very interesting discussions about how to rebuild the spire that was itself a construction of the 19th century. And I'm loving seeing all of these different ideas of how to bring the architecture of Notre Dame into the 21st century and how to connect the medieval past and the present in new and imaginative ways.
It's important to say in studying art history that you can look objectively at an object or a piece of architecture. And I'm thinking about your book from 2004, which was an award-winning book titled The Image of an Ottoman City, Architecture in Aleppo.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, like Notre Dame Cathedral, something can have dual narratives. Mm-hmm. Or more than that, it can be a narrative of reverence and love, enduring passion, and a narrative of oppression and pain, and representative of a dark side of a life experience for people. And you can document that, but you try to look at something objectively in its history and path. Am I right?
Mm-hmm. And I was very interested in both documenting the sort of straight art history of this object or of Aleppo, the city that I worked on in the past. But I, at every turn, I discovered documents and saw testimonies about the deep connection that people formed with this object and with architecture. And I wanted to understand that more. It was as if the object itself exercised its own agency, its own power. Objects like the Zaytun Gospels are considered to be miraculous. They are not inert objects. They are very potent objects that can accomplish miracles in the world. So I wanted to really understand how medieval people understood that and how people understand that today, how believers see sacred objects today. And what is that relationship between an object that is enhanced also by these incredible aesthetic qualities?
And do you believe in the miraculous qualities of objects?
Beth, I have to say, when I was in the presence of the Canon Tables at the Getty in a beautiful, you know, museum hall surrounded by many other visitors, I could feel the pull of this object. It's not just a work of art to me.
Hmm. So has this work spawned new curiosities for you? Where do you go next in your research?
Many different directions. I'm pulled in many different directions. I'm very interested in these objects that, after atrocities or genocide, that have survived these atrocities, how they reinvent themselves in different contexts. And who are the people, especially the art dealers or other middlemen, who become purveyors of sacred objects for the art market. So there are some very interesting stories to be told about New York art dealers in the 30s and 40s who were involved in excavating but also buying objects from the Middle East, some of them like the Zaytun Gospels, survivor objects, and others newly discovered objects, and how they also created what we now understand as the field of Islamic art or the field of Byzantine art. So it's a very dynamic moment where art history is shifting and where Americans are discovering a wider world in a very interesting way.
Hmm. Congratulations on the acclaim and the attention for this book, the place that it's holding for people, not only in a historical sense, but sort of in a detective style piece of literature, because you really had to go back and trace so much history and intrigue and be a little secretive at times about all this, right?
Yes. And I wanted to write the story of this book like a detective novel, because I wanted to take the story to a wider public. So I didn't want to talk to only other art historians. And it was hard, but I'm just so happy that the book is able to connect with an audience.
The book is The Missing Pages. Dr. Hegnar Zeitlian Wattenpah will present the story at the Minetti Schrem Museum on the UC Davis campus on April 25th at 7 o'clock. We've posted more information. The pictures inside are beautiful. I think if you have never dipped into any of the history of the Armenian Genocide before, this is a fascinating place to begin. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure to have you here. This is Insight on CAP Radio. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Tyler, the creator, is the producer and rapper who founded an alternative hip-hop collective called Odd Future. His album in 2017, Flower Boy, was nominated for a Grammy. And that album is the focus of a new season of the podcast Dissect, which is created, produced, and hosted by Sac State alum Cole Kushner. So if Cole is in the studio, I know that means the new season has just launched, and here he is.
Yep.
Welcome back to Insight.
Thanks for having me.
I want to go back to after season two. You put a call out to listeners to say, what do you want me to dissect for the next season? And Flower Boy by Tyler, the creator, was on the short list. You ended up picking Frank Ocean's Blonde. So why did you come back to this record?
I think its presence just never left me, and it didn't leave a lot of people either. It just, you know, I always try to give the album a little bit of breathing time since it, you know, from the point of release. And at that point, when people were requesting it, it had just come out, and I was like, well, let's give it a little bit of time. And the album never left me, never left the fans, and so it just seemed like a natural a choice for season four.
You're a student of music theory, music history. How much do you know about an album before you decide to dive in and dissect it?
Yeah, mostly I just know if I like it or not. And, you know, I'll do some preliminary research just to make sure that it has enough, like, thematic meat to kind of, you know, undergo a, you know, 13-episode, eight-hour scrutiny of analysis. But I really love the real-time unpacking and discovering myself, because I feel like some of that energy ends up into the show, where if I'm excited about a discovery, then it's going to translate to the show and to the listeners.
We're going to hear a few clips, but I think we should set up who Tyler, the creator, is as a person and a personality before diving into his music. And in some cases, it's hard to understand all of his lyrics. So give us some context.
Yeah, sure. So I guess Flower Boy in general was a really big turning point for Tyler, the creator. He came out when he was 17. He got famous really fast. And he was pretty controversial in his, I would say, first couple of years. He was young and likes to push people's buttons, as young people do. And so a lot of that kind of punk rock kind of attitude ended up in his music and his lyrics. And so he got this reputation early on for being this, like, provocateur and just kind of this rascal. And then with this album, he really showed a maturity. And it was a maturity that everyone kind of knew was there, because he was always extremely talented, despite his antics. And this, for the first time, really showcased his talent to its full potential. And also, the subject matter really kind of explains some of his antics before. So I think we're going to start with Forward, I believe, which is the album's first song. And this really sets up the underlying themes of the entire album, which is it's a beautiful album.
How many cars can I buy till I run out of drive? How much drive can I have until I run out of road? How much road can they pave until I run out of land? How much land can it be until I run in the ocean and go with the motions and all the plans? See, I was never into the beaches and all the sands. See, I was in the woods with flowers, rainbows, and posies falling out of my pocket. But y'all wanna know if I swam to cool down? How much cooler can I get until I run out of fans? How many fans can I have until they turn on the AC? If the AC blow, well, then I'm TNT. I'm gone.
I'm gone and I'm finished. And I ain't see my friends in a minute.
Where do you begin? With lyrics? With a beat?
I usually begin with the music. This one's pretty straightforward. Most of the music relies on a sample from a German band called Can. But for this particular song, it's really the lyrics that are going to take, you know, most of the analysis on the episode. And that's because, you know, the song's titled Forward, which is, if you think about the album like a book, which it has a very compelling story arc, a very deliberate story arc. Forward, as in a forward in a book, is kind of this preface, and it lays out the main themes of the album. And for this song, he starts out with, you know, how many cars can I buy till I run out of drive? And the narrative of the album is a car ride at sunset, and it's kind of this metaphor for him being directionless, and he's just going on this drive, not really know where he's going in life. And he also mentions the ocean, which the car, the sports car and the ocean are these two reoccurring symbols that he's going to elaborate on throughout the entire album. And he says them right here in the first four lines of the album. So, you know, it's very deliberate, very thought out, the way that he lays out this album. And it's very beautiful how he does this just in the opening lines of the song. There's just a lot to unpack. 40-minute episode on just this one song. So, yeah.
If that felt layered and deep, he goes even deeper.
Yeah.
And that leads us into the next track that we're going to listen to. You're going to have to explain to everyone the phrase he's saying, because I didn't get it when I first listened to it.
Yeah, so the song is called Garden Shed. And so one thing that I should set up before we listen, Tyler was once accused of homophobia in his early career, mostly because he used homophobic slurs in his lyrics. On this album, he comes out as being gay, and Garden Shed, going along with this nature symbolism, Garden Shed is akin to being in the closet. It's essentially an outdoor closet. So it ties into this nature kind of thematic material that he's developing. And this is the centerpiece of the entire album. It's track 7 of 14. And this is the moment that he comes out of the closet. And he's, you know, you're going to hear him say Garden Shed, Garden Shed, Garden Shed. And then you're going to hear him kind of telling his story about his sexuality.
For the Gaudian, that is what I was hiding. That was real love I was in. Ain't no reason to pretend. Garden shit, garden shit, garden shit, garden shit for the garçons. The feelings that I was Gaudian. Heavy on my mind, all my friends lost. They couldn't read the signs. I didn't want to talk. I tell them my location and I ain't want to walk. Truth is, since a youth kid, thought it was a phase. Thought it'd be like the phrase poof, gone. But it's still going on. Big fan of the bass 10. Polka dot knows how it goes. Had to keep it on the subwoofer. Couple butterflies wanna float. I was always like, man, really interested, but I bagged the brats. My boys like, bruh. This is crucial subject matter, sensitive like cooking batter. To the temperature that's rising, stepping on that ladder, trying to grab the rings of Saturn. I'm a planet by the time you hit it. Shit and chatter about the heat it will not matter.
Say more about what he does with this.
Yeah, so there's a lot to unpack. What's beautiful about this moment is that there's a 2.5-minute introduction before he even says a word. And it's kind of this sonic representation of his hesitancy to express this. There's a lot of false starts in the song. And so when this moment, when he starts to say Garden Shed, I mean, I get chills every time I hear it, because it's really the pinnacle of his story. This is him. It's coming out publicly because it's published as art that people are going to hear, but it's really the moment in the album and in the narrative where he's coming out to himself. He's accepting this about himself. And the interesting thing, again, is that it's track 7 of 14, so you would think it's the end of the story, but it's actually a new beginning, because now he's going to work his way towards telling how he feels to someone else. So the rest of the album is him building up the courage to tell this person that he is attracted to, a male, that he's attracted to them. So the album actually ends with that moment, which is, so you get this kind of dual conclusion, one where he comes out to himself and acknowledges this about himself. And then the actual conclusion, track 14, is him expressing how he feels to someone else. So
I have learned through you, Cole, to listen to the different levels that are happening, the music level with the lyric level, enough so that then you can just let go and feel it. And because of that, if something is truly authentic and comes from a very deep place, it just rises right up. And I feel it in that track. I am witnessing you feel it, and you've had to have listened to that track.
Many times.
Many, many times. And I think that's another sign of it, is does it stay true every time you hear it?
Yeah, and I think that's the power of great art. You know, there can be a popular song that reaches number one, you know, and it might be gone in 3-4 months. But music like this, and I try to choose these albums deliberately, and again, that's why I like to let it rest since its release date, just to make sure it has that resonance. But true art, great art, it's timeless. And again, just like you said, you feel it every time. And if you're feeling it every time, it's working on us on a level that we really don't understand. And that's what I try to unpack on the show, is like, why do these songs resonate? Why do these albums stay with us when, you know, 9 times out of 10, music comes and goes. And that's really what my show is about, is really learning from these artifacts, these like historical things that in 100 years' time are going to represent who we are today.
That's Cole Kushner, the producer and host and creator of the podcast Dissect, which just launched its season 4, focusing on Flower Boy by Tyler, the Creator. Let's talk about the Webby Awards real quickly,
sure.
Because back in December, New York Times culture writer Wesley Morris chose your podcast as one of the 5 great podcasts from 2018. And there's been so much good review of this podcast, but for it to come from Wesley Morris meant what to you?
The New York Times was a big one, definitely. Yeah, it was very humbling knowing where it started, basically me doing this at night, you know, after my family went to sleep while I was working at Temple Coffee, to where it's gone now is like really surreal still, to be honest. And I think part of that just is because I still produce a show in my bedroom. I record in my bedroom alone. So it's like this really weird thing to see it, you know, a very intimate experience, and then I share it with the world, and then, you know, it's doing well, which is, you know, very humbling.
You were just nominated, congratulations, for a Webby Award.
Thank you.
And the awards were just announced yesterday, today?
Today, yeah.
And the person that beat you happened to be
Wesley Morris.
Wesley Morris.
Came in second. Thank you for everyone that voted. But yeah, if I was going to lose to anyone, that's the perfect person to lose to. And he has a great show, so no hard feelings.
All right. Fans continue to say, will you dissect the album Lemonade by Beyonce? Do you think that'll ever happen?
Well, Lemonade just... Well, I work for Spotify. The show is a Spotify original podcast now. And Lemonade was just published on Spotify today after 3 years of being exclusively on Tidal. So it's in the running officially. So do it if I want to.
Well, there's a lot to talk about with this. I think we've only begun the conversation for this season. So I hope we can talk once more about season 4 while
sure.
It's underway.
Yeah. Maybe come back when the finale.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Congratulations, Cole.
Thank you very much.
Always great to have you in the studio. That is Cole Kushner. His new season of the podcast Dissect has launched. We've posted a link, or you can find it wherever you get your podcasts. And that's Insight for today. I'm Beth Ruiak. Our senior producer is Helen Barrington. Our producers are Cody Drabble, Bert Johnson, and Kate Gonzalez. Technical director is Mark Jones. Engineer today, Antonio Munoz. Our executive producer is Joe Barr. Thanks for joining us.